Hello, and welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices and move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. There's only one death notice in today's Arizona Republic. It's Patricia H. Kennedy, age 83, from Chandler, and it says that that she passed away on November 20th. Turning now to the business section of today's Arizona Republic, headline at the top of the page, Cancer Drugs Show Unprecedented Results. Celcuity medicine used as part of TRIO for breast cancer treatment. Celcuity said on July 28th that its experimental combination treatment delayed the progression of a type of advanced breast cancer in a late-stage study, sending the biotech firm's shares surging to a record high. The drug, gedatolisib, in combination with Pfizer's Ibrance and AstraZeneca's endocrine therapy Faslodex, reduced the risk of disease progression or death by 76% compared to Faslodex alone in previously treated HR-positive HER2 advanced breast cancer patients. HR-positive HER2 breast cancer accounts for about 70% of all breast cancers. The study showed unprecedented results, Leerink Partners analyst Andrew Barron said. Gedatolisib could become a new standard of care as a second-line treatment in breast cancer, especially in the community settings, Barron said. Celcuity's triple combination treatment helped patients live for an average of 9.3 months without progression of the disease, compared to about 2 months with Faslodex. Gedatolisib belongs to a class of drugs called PAM inhibitors, which include Novartis's Afinitor and AstraZeneca's Truqap. Celcuity projects revenue potential of $5 billion for the treatment in the second-line treatment setting. The treatment was better tolerated in the late-stage trial than a previous early-stage study, with lower rates of high blood sugar and inflammation in the tissue lining in the mouth, the company said, without offering further details. The study also showed that a double combination of gedatolisib and Ibrance increased survival without progression of the disease in patients by 7.4 months on average, compared to about 2 months with Faslodex. Celcuity plans to apply for U.S. marketing approval in the fourth quarter. The next headline in this section, U.S. and EU aerospace rivals unite on trade. Deal reached to preserve tariff-free aircraft trade. A provisional deal between the United States and European Union to exempt aircraft from tariffs avoids a potential threat to jet production and deliveries in both regions and caps months of uncharacteristic unity among plane-making rivals. The framework deal, announced July 27th, will see the United States impose a 15% import tariff on most EU goods, but offer protection for industries including aerospace, with zero-for-zero tariffs on aircraft and parts, European officials said. Following intense lobbying, it spares an industry that is often a lightning rod for trade tensions. The World Trade Organization was tested to its limits by a 17-year dispute over Airbus and Boeing subsidies before a truce in 2021. Aircraft, engines, spare parts, and components from landing gear to seats had faced potentially higher costs, and some jet deliveries look set to be disrupted by the threatened U.S. tariffs that would have compounded supply chain problems. Still, questions remain over detailed implementation of the deal and whether it will extend to other components like space. We're just waiting until we see these things written down, one European industry official told Reuters. Airbus said it had taken note of the deal. A stable and predictable trade environment is essential for our highly integrated global aerospace industry, it said. Boeing had no immediate comment. The July 27th agreement follows a discreet and unusually united campaign to revert to a landmark 1979 agreement between more than 30 nations that mandated duty-free trading in civil aircraft, an industry that only a few years earlier had torn itself apart over trade disputes on subsidies involving Airbus and Boeing, found itself in lockstep on both sides of the Atlantic. But two terms from the industry's previous trade handbook were quietly dropped, sources said, multilateral and WTO. The 1979 agreement on trade in civil aircraft that eliminated tariffs on aircraft and parts is one of a handful of industry-specific deals that survived from an earlier round of trade talks when the WTO opened in 1995. President Donald Trump, who once called the WTO, quote, the single worst trade deal ever made, unquote, appears to prefer bilateral deals over broad alliances from trade to security, and multilateralism is one of the biggest bugbears of his America First philosophy. Lobbying was intense from all quarters, but industry sources highlighted a discreet but influential role played by GE Aerospace CEO Larry Culp. Culp told Reuters in April that he had advocated reestablishing the tariff-free regime for the aerospace industry during a meeting with Trump at the White House. He said the position was understood by the administration, stressing that the zero-duty regime had helped the U.S. aerospace industry reach a $75 billion annual trade surplus. Industry officials also argued aerospace was interconnected and that U.S. tariffs would not favor Boeing at the expense of its European rival Airbus, but merely hurt everyone. GE did not have any immediate comment on the new deal. In May, Trump reached a trade accord with Britain, which tested the ground by restoring duty-free trade in jet engines. After the U.S.-UK trade deal, aerospace industry officials urged the White House to use it as a template for future trade negotiations. GE's Culp and Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian mentioned the deal as a template to follow. The agreement stops short of restoring the whole 1979 agreement and focuses on the single largest aerospace markets. Boeing typically delivers 17% of its jets to Europe, while Airbus delivers some 12% to the United States, some of which are assembled locally, according to Boeing and Cirium data. But Europe and the United States are each other's largest market for aircraft components, according to French industry lobby GIFAS. Although the agreement relieves one significant source of pressure, there are concerns that Boeing, Airbus, and their suppliers could still be caught up indirectly in trade tensions between Washington and China as they seek to do business there. Aerospace companies are also awaiting findings from an ongoing U.S. trade investigation into aerospace. In May, the U.S. Commerce Department launched a Section 232 national security investigation into imports of commercial aircraft, jet engines, and parts that could form the basis for tariffs or quotas. U.S. airlines who met the department say that much of the focus has been on China and concerns over potential further disruption to key supplies, on top of rare earths and magnets. U.S. carriers currently face 50% tariffs on imports of the jets, which Embraer says could add $9 million per plane. Continuing with business, Brazil is to raise funds for climate projects. Country turns to investors for their $4 billion goal. Brazil is in talks with global investors, including TPG and Brookfield, to raise nearly $4 billion for climate-focused projects as it ramps up a green finance push against of hosting the COP30 Climate Summit in November. Led by State Development Bank BNDES, the move is the latest attempt by President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva's government to encourage private sector investment in the climate agenda of Latin America's largest economy amid rising fiscal pressure. Together with BNDES, we are talking to some of the biggest asset managers like Brookfield and TPG and others that could be partners in the funds, Tatiana Rosito, Brazil's Secretary for International Affairs at the Finance Ministry, told Reuters. Under the plan, due to be formally launched in August with a public call for investment, BNDES will provide $906.3 million in seed capital, said two sources with knowledge of the matter, both of whom requested anonymity given the confidential nature of the discussions. BNDES did not respond to a request for comment. Brookfield and TPG are among the biggest investors in companies and projects focused on helping the world shift to a low-carbon economy, and both are working closely with Altera, the world's largest private climate-focused investment fund. Altera was launched during the COP28 climate talks in Dubai in 2023 with an initial commitment of $30 billion from the United Arab Emirates government. Brookfield and TPG are both running funds seeded by Altera that can invest in countries like Brazil. Other firms approached by BNDES include BlackRock, the world's biggest asset manager, with more than $12 trillion in assets, impact investor Just Climate, growth private equity investor LightRock, and local firms including Patria, Vinci, and Perfin. All declined to comment. Brazil has already issued sovereign bonds that tie the use of proceeds to its sustainability agenda, while the Eco Invest Brazil program aims to reduce the risk of projects, for example, around currency volatility, to make it easier for private sector investors to join in. The government last year also launched its Climate and Ecological Transformation Investment Platform to connect investors with projects in sectors including forest conservation, greening heavy industry, and energy storage. Monies raised in the upcoming capital call would not be limited to emerging industries, though, and could also support more mature sectors, such as wind and solar power, one of the sources said. The bank expects to receive proposals from asset managers by October. And time now to turn to the sports section in today's Arizona Republic. First page of this section, biggest headline, Suarez good to go after injury scare. D-backs third baseman avoids finger break after being hit by pitch. The Diamondbacks on Tuesday, July 29th, received good news on third baseman Eugenio Suarez, who was hit in the right index finger by a fastball late in the previous night's game. After his x-ray revealed nothing broken, Suarez underwent a CT scan and an MRI that did not reveal a more serious injury. Even though he was shaking hands gingerly, wore no splint or anything protective over his finger before Tuesday's game against the Tigers. "We got the news we were looking for," manager Torey Lovello said. 2 hours before the first pitch, Lovello wasn't ready to say that Suarez would be available to pinch hit. Suarez had to test his right hand's ability to grip and swing a bat before that determination was made. Blaze Alexander got the start at third base in the July 19th second game of the three-game series at Detroit, which won the season opener July 28th with 5-1. Lovello would like Suarez to wear protective gear over his hands when hitting, but Suarez has been resistant to do this. "It's a very raw area for sure. And then when you've got the hands and the bones directly on the bat, there's very little give," Lovello said. "We've luckily dodged a bullet with Gino several times, and others, we haven't." The injury came as Suarez has been the focus of ongoing trade speculation. With many baseball observers pegging him as one of the most valuable trade options available before the July 31st trade deadline. And Torrey's back in town. 41 of Lovello's 303 career major league games as a player took place in Detroit, as the Tigers were his original team. He made his major league debut on September 10th, 1988, against the Yankees in New York. Lovello's managerial career has been influenced by his manager in Detroit, the legendary Sparky Anderson. "I'll never forget what I learned from an incredible manager by the name of Sparky Anderson," Lovello said. "The lessons, the life lessons, the things that he brought to the table for me every single day are things that I do now. He was a little bit ahead of his time. He cared about what the player thought. He was firm, he was fair, he was consistent, and I kind of live in that same space as well, he said. Continuing with baseball, revisiting Sandberg's retirement 30 years later. This is written by Bob McManaman, a columnist for the Arizona Republic. Baseball and the sporting world lost an icon and a legend on July 28th with the passing of former major leaguer Ryne Sandberg. A Hall of Fame second baseman who rose to stardom with the Chicago Cubs, Sandberg died at age 65 following a long battle with cancer. 30 years ago, in April 1995, I spoke with Sandberg to preview the release of his book, Second to Home, which explained his reasons behind retiring from baseball in 1994, among other things. Sandberg returned to the Cubs for the 96-97 seasons and would later become a coach and manager for the Philadelphia Phillies. Here is the story that ran from our conversation in the Arizona Republic. Is that so wrong? Can't a guy just wake up one morning and realize that after 17 years of being a full-time baseball player, it was time to become a full-time father? That's exactly what happened to Ryne Sandberg on the morning of June 11, 1994. 2 days later, the beloved second baseman for the Chicago Cubs officially walked away from the game and a $16 million contract and came home to Arizona to be with his two children. Some people couldn't accept that, though. Maybe it's because the sports world has such a hard time letting its heroes say goodbye. Maybe Sandberg's wish to be a daddy again sounded too rich and suspiciously curious. In the days that followed his retirement, the rumors began to circulate across the country. Some of them were laughable, Sandberg said, and some of them were sick. It's been almost a year now since Chicago's other number 23 hung it up for real, but the hearsay continues even today. I had to do something, he said. So he wrote a book, Second to Home, due to hit the bookstore shelves in the coming days, should quell all the gossip and put the rumors to rest. In the book, co-written by Barry Rosner, the Cubs beat writer for the Arlington Heights Daily Herald since 1989, Sandberg enthusiastically defends his decision to quit smacking fastballs and turning to double plays at age 34. Second to Home, bonus books, $22.95, traces Sandberg's childhood in Spokane through his days in the minor leagues, and finally to his 13-year career with the Cubs, which turned sour after playing for 11 different managers and seeing twice that many teammates get shown the door by general manager Larry Himes, who has since been demoted by the club. There were a lot of questions on why I decided to retire, a lot of speculation on some things, and I just wanted to clear that up, tell my story, set the record straight, Sandberg told the Arizona Republic earlier this week. Another reason I decided to do it was that I found it a lot of fun to reminisce about some of the good times. It was a good way to get rid of some of the frustration that took place during the last few years I was there. Subtitled Ryne Sandberg Speaks Up, Rhino does exactly that in several chapters of his 298-page autobiography. He openly criticizes the Cubs organization, especially Himes, and offers dozens of juicy baseball barbs and some hilarious locker room anecdotes. The purpose wasn't to try and rip as many people as I could, Sandberg said of the book, which he sold 500 copies of last week during a 90-minute signing session in Los Angeles. I just spoke my true feelings the best I could. It has been widely speculated that his marital situation was a factor in his decision to retire, but Sandberg quashes that notion early and often in the book, writing, "Millions of people have personal problems, but they don't quit their jobs because of them, and neither did I." Sandberg and his wife of 15 years, Cindy, separated 10 days after his retirement. He writes that he had no idea it was coming. They remain good friends, however, and Ryne gets to spend quality time with Justin, 13, and Lindsay, 11. They go everywhere together, from water skiing outings to camping and fishing trips. He's there whenever one of them has a ball game or a recital or just needs a hug. In the book, Sandberg writes he got heartaches driving down Lakeshore Drive on his way to ball games at Wrigley Field and watching families play together on the beach. Every time he drove by, the scene was harder to watch. I miss those types of things regular people get to do, he said during a telephone interview from his Phoenix home. When you're locked up with a baseball schedule like I was for 17 years, it just got to the point where I had to say, that's it, that's enough. Truth be told, Sandberg also had enough with the changing scene in baseball, the disrespect shown to some players, and the lack of respect to the game shown by younger players, who he writes are more concerned about what suits to buy than what pitcher they were scheduled to face that day. He also had enough of Himes, the former Chicago GM, whom he said ripped the Cubs to shreds right before my eyes. The Cubbies, he said, became a rudderless ship drifting through time, wasting the prime years of my career. By the time Jose Vizcano was traded in the spring of 94, we only had three players remaining from the day Larry Himes took over, only 2 years before, Sandberg writes. What's worse, Sandberg tells, is that Himes was removing guys who wanted to be Cubs and replacing them with guys who didn't seem to want to be anywhere. I didn't feel like I was part of a ball club anymore, he told the Republic. Larry tore it down. In one chapter titled The Summer of Torture, Sandberg paints a very telling portrait of Himes, now a special assignment scout and director of Arizona operations for the club. It has to do with Sandberg collecting his 2,000th career hit on June 3, 1993. He did it in Colorado against the expansion Rockies. After the game, Rockies general manager Bob Gebhardt sent a bottle of champagne down to the Chicago clubhouse in honor of the occasion. But Himes, Sandberg said, never even came down to shake my hand. Himes was unavailable for comment. There are other tantalizing tales in second to home, like the garage Sandberg called home in his first season in the minor leagues in Helena, Montana. Then there's his first visit to Hohokam Park in Mesa. Ironically, the day after he and Cindy toured the facility out of curiosity, he was traded from the Phillies to the Cubs. One of the funniest stories in the book deals with double play partner, shortstop Shawan Dunston, and a memorable at-bat against fireballer Nolan Ryan. Gene Michael, then the Cubs skipper, had been claiming all day that Ryan was purposely scuffing the ball. He finally yelled at Dunston to have the umpire check it out. Are you crazy? Dunston said. Ryan will hit me between the eyes. A side-splitting exchange between Dunston and Michael is then described. Something almost as laughable, Sandberg said, is the notion that he will return to the game, a la Michael Jordan, and resume his career with the Cubs. No, it's not going to happen, he told the Republic. I've still got my two kids. That's the prime reason I retired in the first place. Sandberg did, however, say he wouldn't have left the Cubs if today's new management team had been in place then, and if the team had been winning in the summer of 94. So what are his plans? For now, he says, he will try to spend as much time as he can with Justin and Lindsay. Beyond that, the future could bring anything, perhaps even a job with the Arizona Diamondbacks, the Valley's Major League expansion team that will begin play in 3 years. Toward the end of his book, Sandberg mentions that could be a possibility. He said he's good friends with Jerry Colangelo, the Diamondbacks' managing owner and chief executive officer. I love the game of baseball, Sandberg said, and maybe down the road I'll get involved with the team. In what capacity, I don't know. I'm still enjoying retirement. And that was a look back at an interview with columnist Bob McManaman with Ryan Sandberg 30 years ago, on the occasion of his recent death. Continuing with baseball, Class A target of MLB gambling inquiry. Okay, so it's not the 1919 Chicago White Sox scandal. The Cleveland Guardians are not being accused of throwing games. Now, if you're talking about bad judgment, with two pitchers potentially betting on baseball or having an association with known gamblers, we're about to find out if they also threw away their entire baseball careers. Guardians all-star closer Emmanuel Clase, considered one of the best relievers in the game, and who certainly could have brought the Guardians a haul of prized prospects at the trade deadline, was placed on non-disciplinary paid leave on July 28th through August 31st as MLB launches an investigation of whether he violated the league's gambling policy. Class A joins his close friend, Guardians pitcher Luis Ortiz, who was placed on paid leave July 3rd, after unusual gambling activity on two pitches that he threw far outside the strike zone in June this season. Gamblers wagered high amounts of money on whether those two pitchers would result in a ball or hit batsmen. It was during MLB's investigation with Ortiz when Class A's name suddenly surfaced. He was not under investigation at the time Ortiz was forced to take a leave of absence. Now, 3 weeks later, Class A is also under investigation for potentially gambling on games in which he performed, facing a lifetime ban if found guilty. The Guardian said in a statement that no additional players or club personnel are expected to be impacted by the investigation. It's certainly possible that another player or employee surfaces in the gambling investigation, but the Guardian's sentiments were echoed by MLB officials who have no knowledge of improprieties involving players from any other team during this investigation. Class A, 27, would be the highest profile player since Pete Rose nearly 40 years ago, if proved that he bet on baseball games in which he played. Rose received a lifetime ban from baseball in 1989 for gambling on the Cincinnati Reds games when he managed. Rose died last September, but was reinstated by Commissioner Rob Manfred, making him eligible to be placed in the Hall of Fame ballot. Class A is a three-time All-Star and two-time winner of the Mariano Rivera Award as the American League's best reliever. He finished third in the Cy Young race last year with a .61 ERA, and his career 1.88 ERA is the second lowest among relievers who've pitched at least 100 games. Class A is in the fourth year of a five-year $20 million contract. He's being paid $4.5 million this year, with a guaranteed salary of $6 million in 2026 and $10 million club options in 2027 and 28. Guardians president Chris Antonetti addressed the team on July 28th, says their players are well educated, that the dangers of sports gambling in spring training, with signs on the clubhouse walls reminding them of the danger and potential repercussions. Certainly, no matter what the outcome of the investigation, it's a gut punch to the Guardians' postseason hopes. They are 3.5 games out of a wild card berth and suddenly don't have the closer for at least the next 4.5 weeks. Two very good pitchers aren't going to be available to pitch for us in the near term, Antonetti told Cleveland reporters, and so we have to assess how that impacts our thinking. It was 5 years ago that Class A received an 80-game suspension for testing positive for boldenone, a banned substance, delaying his Guardians career before leading the American League in saves in three consecutive seasons. Now, if found guilty, it abruptly ends his Guardians career and begs the question heard round baseball, who's next? And some basketball on the front page of the section. Fever star Clark is still out with injury and won't play versus the Mercury. The Phoenix Mercury, 16-9, continue their five-game road trip with the Indiana Fever, 14-12. The Fever have won the last two games, but star Caitlin Clark was ruled out for the fifth straight game as she deals with a right groin injury. Clark has not played since the injury on July 15th. Per Indy Star reporter Chloe Peterson, the Fever announced there were no signs of additional damage or injuries, but did not provide a timetable for her return. Guard Kelsey Mitchell leads the Fever with 20.2 points per game, followed by center Alia Boston's 15.4 points. The Mercury, who've dealt with injuries due to the core throughout the season, did not have any injuries listed on the report on July 29th. Clark was the only player listed out on the Fever injury report. The Mercury have gone 1-1 in the first two games of the road trip and seem to find their rhythm in the previous game against the Washington Mystics. The post-All-Star break slump claimed two losses for the Mercury, but the healthy squad progressed with five players scoring in double figures against the Mystics. The defense also held the Mystics to 26 points in the second half, a 20-point difference from the first half. While the big three of Kaylee Cooper, Alyssa Thomas, and Satu Sabali have been playing with each other over the last three games after Copper and Sabali overcame injuries, it's been the bench that has stood out. Over the last two games on the road, the Mercury's bench has scored 35 points. Forward Dawana Bonner has factored into several games since joining the Mercury after she was waived by the Fever in June. In her six games with the Mercury, Bonner has averaged 11.5 points and 5.0 rebounds. Bonner's best effort came when she scored 22 points and grabbed 11 rebounds off the bench against Golden State Valkyries on July 14th. The Mercury enjoyed a positive sign from guard Kit Laxa as she broke out with 13 points and two three-pointers in her last game after being held scoreless in two of her previous four games. Thomas has remained the backbone of the Mercury so far, averaging a leading 9.4 assists per game. The MVP candidate has 11 double-doubles and one triple-double this season. Sabali is still working her way back from an ankle injury, but is averaging a team-leading 18 points per game. Copper has dealt with several injuries this season, but has averaged 10 points in the three games since returning from a hamstring injury. The Mercury Fever game will be shown locally on Arizona's Family TV and Arizona Family Sports at 4 p.m. It will also be shown nationally on ESPN3. And we'll take a look at some sports briefs before we leave this section. The Water calls Ledecky past Quadrella to 1500 gold. Katie Ledecky claimed a sixth 1500-meter freestyle title and a record-extending 22nd World Championships gold medal in Singapore on Tuesday, as Romanian rocket David Popovici added the men's 200 crown to his Paris Olympic triumph. There was also gold for Australia's backstroke queen, Kaylee McCowan, who foiled American rival Regan Smith once again to claim the 100 title in a thriller, while South Africa's Peter Ketsi clinched the men's race. Unbeaten in the 1500 since the age of 13, world record holder Ledecky came home ahead of Italian Simona Quadrella, with Australian Lani Pallister winning bronze at the World Aquatics Championships arena. The American great was under the world record pace, 15:20.48, for all but a few laps before fading in the last length to finish at 15:26.44, more than 5 seconds ahead of Quadrella. Wrapped in an American flag, Ledecky beamed as she exited the pool, having clinched a 28th World Championships medal, moving past Ryan Lochte in the all-time list. Only Michael Phelps, with 33, has more. At 28 and with the Los Angeles Games on the horizon, Ledecky said she had no desire to take a breather. "I really hate taking breaks, so I start dreading the impending break that's coming after this meet," she said. "The water always calls me back. The teammates always call me back. And I'm just happy to keep enjoying it." Ledecky's 22nd world title is the most by any female swimmer and second only to Phelps's overall record of 26. And man pleads guilty to stalking Fever star Clark. A 55-year-old Texan man pleaded guilty Monday to stalking and harassing Indiana Fever superstar Caitlin Clark. Michael Lewis, a native of Denton, Texas, was sentenced to 18 months in prison. The sentence includes credit for time served at the Marion County Adult Detention Center since he was arrested at an Indianapolis hotel in January and charged with felony stalking after allegedly sending repeated threats and sexually violent messages to Clark via social media. According to his sentence, Lewis must also stay away from Clark and from Fever or Indiana Pacers games and cannot use the internet during his sentence. The judge also recommended mental health treatment for Lewis, who was continually disruptive at Monday's meeting, including saying of Clark, "I want her to be safe," and prophesizing about the end of the world. You're listening to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. And time now for the columns and opinions section of today's Arizona Republic. We'll begin with E.J. Montini, columnist with the Arizona Republic. "Helpless when ICE ignores the oath. The law is the law, unless it applies to them." What we hear from Donald Trump's administration his Department of Homeland Security, his Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, is that their masked secret police are scooping up immigrants who show up for scheduled court appearances and hauling them off to detention facilities, like the one in Eloy, because they say it's the law. They say they are law enforcement professionals who've sworn an oath to enforce that law. As I've heard many times, the law is the law. Except, it seems, when it applies to them. Last week, Arizona U.S. Representative Greg Stanton showed up at the Eloy Detention Center in order to check out the facility as part of Congress's oversight responsibility and in order to visit Arizona restaurant owner Kelly Yu, who has been detained for a couple of months and who is one of many individuals who do not belong there. Stanton actually brought a copy of the law giving him the right and the responsibility to visit the facility. It's Public Law 118.47, which reads in part, "Nothing in this section may be construed to require a member of Congress to provide prior notice of the intent to enter a facility described in subsection A for the purpose of conducting oversight." However, when Stanton got to the facility on July 25th, Stanton was denied entry. Something similar happened earlier to U.S. Representative Yasemin Ansari, who had gone to check on detainees who are ill. Stanton said, "I wanted to provide that oversight, and we were denied. I'm not surprised, and we're certainly going to be challenging it." He added, "It's illegal to deny a member of Congress the ability to come in and provide oversight over the facility. When the federal law enforcement ignores the law, every American should be concerned." True, every American should be concerned. And in a nation of laws and not just a dictatorship, the Department of Justice also would be concerned. So concerned, in fact, that officials there would be threatening to arrest anyone at the Eloy facility who violates the law. But that is not happening. Individuals who work for the federal government take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Under Donald Trump, however, many of them seem to have had their fingers crossed behind their backs during their swearing-in ceremonies and actually believe that doing so is a thing. Because if the officials in charge of Homeland Security and ICE believed in honoring their oaths to the Constitution, Representatives Stanton and Ansari would have strolled into the Eloy facility. And if the officials running the Department of Justice believed in honoring their oaths and enforcing the law, they would have told the nice folks running the detention center to let the members of Congress inside or risk being locked up themselves. Dear Leader does not want that to happen, however, so the law is being ignored. Which begs an important question, one that Trump supporters for years have been shouting at immigration reform advocates and journalists and others. These days, it is a question that MAGA faithful, in government and out, should be asking themselves. What part of illegal don't you understand? That was written by E.J. Montini. If you'd like to reach him, you can at ed.montini, M-O-N-T-I-N-I, at arizonarepublic.com. The next opinion comes from Phil Boas, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Arizona fears doxers as much as ICE agents wearing masks. Federal agents who wear masks to enforce immigration laws are making a mistake. They provoke public doubts about themselves. They hand their foes a sword, and as I'll explain later, they project weakness. So yes, I'm a critic. Where I part ways from their fiercest critics is that I know they are not masking to intimidate the public and to play secret police. They have plausible reasons, and they're not alone. The Arizona legislature passed a law in 2023 to do essentially what ICE agents who wear face masks have done, protect themselves from doxing. Dox, that's D-O-X-X, is a term derived from the word documents and has come to signify the research and collection of personal information captured from documents and other postings on the web. The personal information is used to target, attack, intimidate, and otherwise harm individuals. In May 2023, Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs signed Senate Bill 1061 that gave statewide office holders, lawmakers, and election officials the same right as Arizona police officers and judges to strike their names and addresses from certain public records. Turns out, Arizona was ahead of the game. Politico published a report on July 19th that at least a dozen states have taken actions to try to similarly protect the safety of lawmakers and other public officials. A number of them swung into action after the June shooting of former Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman and State Senator John Hoffman and their spouses at their homes. Hortman and her husband both died from their wounds. It isn't clear how their assailant, Vance Luther Beltner, got their home address, but investigators found a notebook he had with 11 data broker sites that sell people's home addresses and other personal information. One of the states working to protect its public officials from doxing is Massachusetts, whose legislature seeks to remove the home addresses of candidates on election ballots, according to Boston.com. The Minnesota shootings prompted Massachusetts lawmakers to act, but they also remember that in 2024, someone used addresses found on a sample ballot to target the homes of Massachusetts U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren and U.S. Representative Lori Trahan with false bomb threats. In other words, they well understand the threat doxing poses to people in public life. Nonetheless, one high-profile official in the state, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, has little tolerance for ICE officers using face masks to protect their identity. Wu has pointedly said that ICE face masks are used to intimidate people, Politico reports. What other definition of secret police is there when people are getting snatched off the street by masked individuals, not being told where they're going, disappeared until someone somehow finds some information? She asked. Another state whose lawmakers are scurrying to protect the personal information of government officials is California. There, lawmakers want to restrict public access to their addresses and phone numbers. But as they act, other California public officials express strong condemnation of ICE officers who use face masks to protect their identity from the same threat. "I don't think you have a right to have a mask and snatch people off the street," Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass told ABC News. "Why are they masked?" California Governor Gavin Newsom said. "It's to increase stress and to increase anxiety." Actually, American law enforcement grew fearful of doxing a long time ago. As early as 2013, police in Los Angeles began to understand that the internet posed a threat to them. That year, someone leaked to the website the private financial information of then police chief Charlie Beck, the Los Angeles Times reported. 2 years later, hackers doxed two LAPD officers after a police-involved shooting on Skid Row that involved a struggle with a suspect over an officer's gun. Hackers published online the officers' names, home addresses, and information on their children's schools, CBS Los Angeles reported. During the social justice protests and riots of 2020, the so-called hacktivists doxed police all across the country, the Associated Press reported. Multiple high-ranking police officials in a number of cities, including Washington, Atlanta, Boston, and New York, have had their personal information shared on social media, including their home addresses, email addresses, and phone numbers. All of this doxing of police led to the removal of officers' names from uniforms in many jurisdictions, with names replaced by an employee number. ICE's use of face masks has become an extension of that, guarding against the practice of activists posting ICE agents' faces on the internet and then using crowdsourcing to identify them. "I'm not going to let my officers and agents go out there and put their lives on the line and their family on the line because people don't like what immigration enforcement is," acting ICE Director Todd Lyons said during a news conference. No law prohibits federal law enforcement officers from covering their faces during an arrest. John Sandweg, former acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, told CNN he doubts that ICE supervisors directed agents to cover their faces during raids. "Officers have a lot of discretion in the field," he said, adding, "This is probably something that was informally discussed in the strategy prior to factoring the arrest." While I sympathize with ICE officers who want to protect their spouses and children from doxing and threats, I don't believe they should wear face masks. They have chosen work that demands they live courageous lives. That is their choice. They made it. They know the risks that go along with that. And they're not the only ones who bear that burden, as we saw with two Minnesota lawmakers shot in their own homes. As uniformed officers, they represent the federal government, and as such, should not hide their faces. A face mask sends all kinds of signals, whether meant to or not, and one of the strongest is that the person wearing one has something to hide or is up to no good. That is a terrible signal to send to the public. It erodes trust, it evokes images of masked men in other contexts doing bad things. But there's another reason. Do we want to live in a society in which the men and women who protect us from criminals are so afraid of those criminals that they don't dare show their faces? No, we are not Mexico or Eastern Europe or Italy, where police are so afraid of criminal syndicates that they often wear masks. In Mexico, police officers in areas controlled by drug cartels have been murdered and their family members executed because their identities have been disclosed. So they mask. We are not that. We never want to become that. So we must never allow the lawbreakers to set the terms. Law officers in face masks give in to lawbreakers who have decided to attack them by weaponizing personal information. The only appropriate response to that is the vigorous pursuit and prosecution of such people. That's who we are. That was written by Phil Boas. He's an editorial columnist with the Arizona Republic. You can email him at Phil, that's P-H-I-L, dot Boas, B-O-A-S, at arizonarepublic.com. And the next opinion comes from guest columnists Dan Keppen and Tom Davis. Yuma feeds the nation. Its farms need water to grow. In Arizona's desert southwest, water is life. It grows the food that fills the grocery stores across the nation, even in the middle of winter. But today, Arizona farms face unprecedented challenges, and our food security hangs in the balance. Yuma County, Arizona, is known as the winter lettuce capital of the world. From November through March, this corner of the Sonoran Desert produces roughly 90% of the leafy greens consumed in the United States. Romaine, spinach, kale, and spring mix grown in Yuma fill salad bowls from Boston to Seattle when fields in other parts of the country lie dormant. Yet, this vital food system is under strain. Arizona is one of the fastest-growing states in the nation, and farmland is vanishing under housing developments and industrial growth. Maricopa County is projected to lose more farmland than anywhere else in the country, according to the American Farmland Trust. At the same time, the Colorado River, the lifeline of the Southwest, has been stretched to its limits by drought and overallocation. This has triggered a fierce debate about how water should be divided among cities, farms, and the environment. Some argue agriculture should tighten its belt and surrender water to urban uses. But that argument misses the big picture. Arizona farmers have been innovating for decades to grow more with less. Nowhere is this clearer than in Yuma, where water from the Colorado River is used with extraordinary care. Local farmers employ high-tech irrigation systems, including leveling fields via global positioning system to eliminate water waste and using soil moisture sensors to apply just the right amount of water at the right time. The result? Yuma area growers produce more than 200,000 acres of crops annually, with some of the highest water use efficiency rates in the country. In some cases, a single acre produces 50,000 heads of lettuce during the winter season. Meanwhile, new players are entering the water competition. Data centers, massive facilities, housing servers for artificial intelligence, cloud computing, and e-commerce consume millions of gallons of water a day for cooling. While technology is vital to modern life, so is food. And unlike many of these facilities, farms return water to the local cycle in the form of fruits, vegetables, and livestock that feed millions. To be fair, some tech companies are innovating. Microsoft has announced data centers designed to consume no water for cooling, and Amazon is piloting the use of recycled water. But these are exceptions, not the rule. We cannot afford to let technology needs overshadow the basic human need for food. This isn't just about Arizona. As domestic farmland disappears, food production shifts overseas, often to places with weaker environmental and labor standards. Today, the U.S. imports more than half of its fresh fruit and nearly a third of its vegetables. That dependency grows every year. Imagine being dependent on foreign food as we once were on foreign oil. A drought, trade disruption, or political crisis abroad could leave supermarket shelves bare and prices skyrocketing. There's also the global climate to consider. When we pave over farmland here, we don't eliminate the demand for food. We push it overseas, where it may contribute to rainforest destruction and higher carbon emissions. Urban conservation is critical, and Arizona cities have made strides. But ensuring that Arizona farms have enough water to grow food is just as important. Technology, innovation, and smart policy can help us balance these needs. If we let the lettuce fields of Yuma dry up, Americans won't just lose access to fresh, affordable greens. In the winter, they'll lose a key part of the nation's food security. We need a water policy that acknowledges the essential role of Arizona agriculture in feeding millions. Without it, we risk trading our winter salad bowl for an empty plate. That was written by Tom Davis and Dan Keppen. Tom Davis is general manager of the Yuma County Water Users Association. Dan Keppen is executive director of the Family Farm Alliance. You can reach them at tdavis@ycwua.org and Dan, D-A-N, at familyfarmalliance.org. Time now for the horoscope. If you're in Aries, reclaim suppressed parts of your personality. For Taurus, unexpressed rage can turn inward. For Gemini, you have memories can be triggered of being misunderstood or not belonging within the community. For Cancer, authority wounds come into the light. For Leo, reevaluate what you've been taught. For Virgo, explore hypervigilance. For Libra, relationships can feel tricky right now. Scorpio, take care of yourself. For Sagittarius, release the pressure you've been feeling. For Capricorn, reliving a place and a time that feels so long ago, emotional triggers from childhood may catch you off guard. For Aquarius, communication is a sore spot today. For Pisces, your value may feel like it's in question today. Turn now to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, for nearly 30 years, my husband and I shared a close, trusting marriage. Months ago, I caught him lying about meetings he was having with a 35-year-old colleague. Then I discovered months of ongoing texts. When I asked for an explanation, he became angry and defensive. His explanation was it was work-related, that I was too controlling, and that I was making a big deal out of nothing. Because I believed this was not a trivial situation, I pressed for some resolution. Unfortunately, further discussions were heated with no resolve, just more withdrawn behavior while the communications continued. Recently, he informed me that he realized his behavior was unacceptable, and he has stopped the communication. He says he loves only me, and he wants me to trust him again. My problem is, after all his secrecy, lies, and defensiveness, I can't do that. He now carries on like nothing has happened, hoping to regain my trust. But for me, the trust has been broken. After many years of marriage, what I thought was a loving marriage, I was blindsided. I've always valued your advice, so please help me to put things in perspective. Signed, Blindsided in Michigan. Dear Blindsided, for nearly 30 years, you had what you thought was a solid relationship with your husband. It's now apparent that he screwed up royally. My question to you is, what do you want from now on? It is possible to rebuild trust after infidelity, but it will take work from both of you. Do you want to sacrifice what you and your husband built together and forge ahead on your own? Your husband cannot act like nothing has happened, because something did. If the two of you are open to healing your broken marriage, it may require the help of a licensed marriage and family therapist, and it may take some time. The ball is in your court. Dear Abby, Carol and I have been friends for 30 plus years. Her marriage was great as long as her husband wasn't using drugs. When he was using, he would abuse her verbally, physically, and emotionally. He passed away, and she's now dating an abusive alcoholic. When he's not drinking, which is maybe 3 days a month, he's very sweet. I've tried telling her that she's enabling him, but she says she loves him. How can I get her to open her eyes before something bad happens? Signed, Worried Friend in Arizona. Dear friend, what Carol really means when she says she loves this addict is that she needs the companionship he provides, and she's willing to put up with the abuse for 3 good days a month. Healthcare providers are required to make a report if they provide medical services to a patient who they suspect is suffering from an injury due to abuse. Short of hauling her to an emergency room if he physically abuses her, there's nothing you can do to save her. Let her know that you are there for her in times of need, and give her the number of the National Domestic Violence Hotline. It's 1-800-799-7233. Again, the National Domestic Violence Hotline number is 1-800-799-7233. And if you'd like to write to Dear Abby, you can contact her at dearabby.com. We have time for a few comics. We'll start with Pickles. Earl is talking to his grandson, Nelson, who's got this big garbage bag over his shoulder. And he says, "Why the long face, son?" And he says, "Grandma's making me take out the garbage." And Earl says, "Look at the bright side. This could be a career move for you." And he looks up at him and says, "A career move?" And he says, "Yes, sirree. This could be your foot in the door to a career as a professional garbage man. They make good money." And then Earl says, "That's not a bag of trash. It's a bundle of opportunity." And little Nelson smiles and says, "Awesome." And in Blondie, she's at her, she's doing her catering job, taking an order. And there are two women sitting across the table from her. And she's taking notes, and the women say, "We're throwing a big bash for our penny-pinching cheapskate coupon clipper club." Blondie says, "Lovely. Any preferences for an entree?" And one woman says, "Yes, charred liver and onions." And the other woman says, "With a side of tofu." And Blondie says, "I don't know how many people would like that." And one of the women says, That's the idea. The fewer people come, the more moolah we save." Blondie says, "Wow, you really are committed to your club's creed." And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under broadcast info and audio.